In Sri Lanka, the guns may be silenced after decades of civil war, but how easy will it be for the island to achieve national reconciliation and address the legitimate aspirations of the minority Tamils? The final stages of the war, leading up to last week's defeat of the Tamil Tiger rebels, saw around 250,000 civilians trapped in the ever-shrinking conflict zone. Nobody yet knows for sure how many civilians died during the final offensive, but the scale of the humanitarian suffering is on a huge scale. The rebels were accused of using the local population as a human shield, while the government was accused of indiscriminate shelling. An estimated 275,000 people have been left displaced by the conflict, and the priority now is ensuring they can be resettled as soon as possible. Many of them emaciated and traumatized, these displaced people poured out of the combat zone in the final stages of the war and have been housed in severely overcrowded closed camps run by the government. The UN and relief organizations have been calling on the government to allow unimpeded access to these camps, saying the restrictions are worsening the humanitarian situation for these people who have already suffered so much. So, just how bad was the suffering of civilians caught up in the line of fire as the two sides battled it out during the war's final weeks? One person who knows from first-hand experience is Vini, a Tamil Catholic humanitarian worker who was based in the so-called safe zone of Vani in northern Sri Lanka. I began by asking him to describe the mood of the Tamil population now that the war is over.
Primarily, it would be sorrow, pain, agony, and also fear.
Are they hopeful that the government will honour its promises to reach out to the Tamil community, to grant them some degree of autonomy, to answer their grievances?
Given the experiences of the past, it will be very difficult for the Tamil community to believe that the government will be very fair to them. Because during the war, the government never kept up to its promises. For example, the no-fire zone was never a no-fire zone. Things like that, and thousands of people were killed. And particularly during the last phase itself, more than 25 to 30,000 people were killed and wounded. And we don't know the fate of the people. How many were killed and how many were wounded, exactly nobody knows.
There's about 300,000 Tamils in these government-run camps, very overcrowded. And the government has not yet honoured the promises to allow unimpeded access to these camps by aid organisations. Do you have any inkling yourself of what conditions are like in these camps? You know, we heard the UN Secretary General describe them as very, very bad, but can you tell us in more detail?
Certain things were being distributed to the people, say like food was allowed at a time, and educational aid was allowed for the children. And in general, the security is highly questionable, and the health condition, medical facilities that are provided, and the separation of the families in various camps.
But do they have enough food and water, the basics?
I don't think so. It's not enough. The government itself cannot manage that. So the necessity of the involvement of the international organizations is a must, but the government has not given access to them so far, even though the pleas have been many.
Do you think that under international pressure the government will give way, or do you think it'll wait until it's carried out this screening of the inmates?
I think that will be closer to the truth.
You yourself were trapped in the so-called safe zone for a number of years, and you were actually holed up in a bunker to escape the shelling for a month or so. Can you tell us something about conditions then?
It is a normal thing that every family and every house had a bunker. So it was not only me, it was a common feature for all the people that they had to hide themselves in bunker. And as the intensity of the operations went on, became more and more aggressive, so the stay in the bunkers also were extended. Initially we could cook and eat and there was space. But as the war came closer and closer to our territories, it was becoming impossible even to have a proper bath or even to cook and eat food. Everything had to be according to the attacks. When the shelling was there, you rush to the bunker to protect yourself. And once the shelling is over and there is a pause, you come out and do your things. And again, once the shelling starts, you go back to the bunker. It was like a back and forth.
So very intensive shelling, as you say, where you couldn't really lead an uninterrupted normal life.
Yeah.
The accounts, of course, of these people who fled during the final final stages of the war, it talked about emaciated people. Did you see yourself, people who were clearly emaciated and short of food?
Of course. For the first time, starvation deaths occurred when I was there. That 13 people died of starvation for the first time in the history of Vanni. Because no agricultural lands, no vegetation, no paddy, nothing. Only we were, the only nutritious food was fish that was available from the sea. Even rice was dwindling, so totally we were dependent on the dry rations issued by the government. And here comes the important factor. The government was, from the beginning, saying that there were 70,000 people in the safe zone. But in fact, 300,000 people had been there, and we were telling that. But now it is proved. So now this, again, the question is, was the government sincere towards the people? Because the food and medicine were used as weapons of war to frustrate the people, perhaps to wean them away from the tigers.
Were people getting fed up with the tigers, fed up with the war, and were they turning against the tigers?
Oh, definitely, because the tigers were becoming more aggressive towards the end, especially from roughly March to May, because they were demanding all the able-bodied persons to join the ranks of the fighting cadres. And that broke down the relationship with the population. And there were a lot of clashes between the people and the tigers. And at times the tigers have beaten the people, killed people, and it was atrocious. So the people were really caught in between the devil and the deep blue sea.
The UN says that there's strong possibilities that both sides were guilty of war crimes. I mean, the tigers that were using the civilians as cannon fodder or human shields, and the government forces that were doing indiscriminate shelling in heavily populated areas. Do you think there are grounds for this?
Definitely, because first of all, about the tigers, I have told you that these tigers were determined not to allow the people to go out. Whether they were used, okay, on the one hand, it can be looked upon as using them as human shields. From another angle, because they didn't want to lose their territory, the de facto territory, however smaller it was, to hold on to that. So these two could be combined in understanding. But definitely the people were not freely allowed to go out even if they wanted. That is true. And on the side of the government, the weapons that were used, and that is the artilleries, the multi-barrel rocket launchers, the supersonic fighter jets, and cluster bombs, very indiscriminately used cluster bombs, and also chemical weapons, all these banned items. And people were getting killed like worms in the no-fire zone.
How traumatized did you find the people were? Can you give us anecdotes that maybe sort of illustrate, you know, how traumatized people were by...
For example, at a time, a man's mother was wounded. And she could have been saved if she were taken to the hospital, but the situation was intense shelling. And the man had no other option but to bury her almost 25% alive still. So this is a typical one example I can give of that. And many people were just buried wherever they were killed. They were never taken to the hospital. And taking the people to the hospital itself is a big process, because the roads are congested, heavy traffic, because 300,000 people occupying about 25-30 square kilometers area, and in the midst of shelling and aerial bombing. So it has been, many people would have been saved, because many of them lost a lot of blood on the way, bleeding. So by the time they reached the hospital, many of them died. Many of them died because lack of medication. So it was very intense and very painful. And traumatization at all levels, because people didn't have enough strength to face it, physical strength, because lack of food, lack of medical facilities, and lack of shelter facilities, and constant threat from the air, because you never know what will happen, terrible anxiety of the people. So the whole life lent itself for traumatization and intense traumatization.
And what about the role of the local Catholic Church in these Tamil areas? What sort of role was it playing?
I think the priests who were living there, as far as I know, they struggled with the people and struggled for their dignity, and they struggled with the tigers to establish justice towards the people and not to be so harsh and turn their venom against the people, and they fought against that. That much I can tell you with certainty.
What do you think are the lessons to be learned from this war?
Lessons to be learned: war is always evil, and I hate war, not only in Sri Lanka, for that in any part of the world, because war is atrocious. It just kills and destroys and butchers people, and the flesh and blood that we have witnessed, I wouldn't like that to happen anywhere else. That is my first lesson. Second lesson is, wars are not created by the people themselves. These are all instigated. And at the third thing is, at the root of this instigation, there is some injustice, institutionalized injustice, which were fought with non-violent means and which were suppressed with violent means. And eventually it turned out to be armed struggle. And I think if the injustices are rectified at the earlier stages, I think we can prevent these human tragedy and catastrophes.
And how easy will it be to win the peace?
It will be very difficult, very difficult.
Why is that?
Given the nature of the divide and the conception that the Sri Lankan country, Sri Lanka belongs only to the Sinhalese and the Buddhists, and all the other minorities have to find their places within the structure. And I think this is basically against the dignity, equality and humanity of all the people. So the country of Sri Lanka to come up and prosper, I think this fundamental dignity and equality of all the people has to be assured. Until then, I think it will be very difficult. This change has to happen if we want to grow together and live peacefully and prosper.
You say about recognizing the dignity of all Sri Lankans or all the people in Sri Lanka, but what specific acts could the government take to try to reach out to the Tamil community and try to overcome this mistrust and achieve reconciliation, however difficult that may be?
The basics will be somehow the struggles boil down to, say, opportunities, equal opportunities. With the independence, somehow the much-needed rectification of the injustices the Sinhalese faced during the period of colonization, they were rectified to a greater extent. But the proportion was not sufficient enough when it comes to the minorities. So the need is, first of all, to assure the Sri Lankans, without any beyond their divide, that all will have the equal opportunity to come up in life. And immediately this refers to some sort of autonomy, not only in the economic sector, but also in the decision-making sector.
Do people there fear that the remnants of the Tamil Tigers will continue to carry out sporadic guerrilla attacks in the future?
Immediately, we don't think so.
So how do you see the future playing out at this stage?
Future playing out, I think it depends much on the political will of the government as well as the political will of the international community, which could help the government to see reality and to go forward rather than redress.
And if you could just maybe pinpoint for me some of the worst experiences either you or these people have undergone in the war?
The worst experience will be the total destruction, utter destruction of a living area. The one is totally destroyed. East is totally destroyed. The war has destroyed wherever the war has taken place. So this is the greatest tragedy, losing one's land, one's livelihood, houses, properties, hard-earned livings. Everything is lost besides that lives. And worst is, for the first time we experienced deaths of fetuses, and that was terrible.
What you mean, because they were aborting?
No. Abortions were taking place because of the shocks.
Oh, I see. Miscarriages.
Miscarriages, that was one. But the other one is the baby within the womb of the mother being injured with shrapnels. For the first time we saw that, and it was terrible. So many thousands of children have lost their limbs and they are amputated. And it is, I think, even to our enemy, that should not happen.
I was speaking to Vinny, a Tamil Catholic humanitarian worker, about his recent experiences in the combat zone of Sri Lanka.